fund. To case number two, 043216, Trustmark Insurance versus General and Cologne Life. Good morning, Mr. Burt.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Tony Burt, and I represent Trustmark Insurance Company in this appeal. Your Honors, the district court expressly found that Cologne made an unambiguous promise to share the risk on 7,000 individual disability insurance policies, and that Trustmark had reasonably and detrimentally relied upon that promise, and that it was foreseeable that Trustmark would rely upon that promise. Nevertheless, Your Honors, the court subsequently concluded that Trustmark had an adequate remedy at law, even though Cologne never even made that argument below. The court held that Trustmark could not rely upon the partial performance exception to the statute of frauds as a result of the fact that there was an adequate legal remedy, so said the court.
Now, of course, Mr. Byrd, it was your burden to show that there was no adequate remedy at law.
We accept that, Your Honor.
And what I'm wondering is, what is your best evidence that future damages couldn't be calculated reliably? I mean, it seems counterintuitive to the whole business of insurance to say that a loss can't be reliably predicted, because that's what insurance companies and actuaries seem to do for a living.
They certainly do it from a business perspective to take risks along those lines, but that is not with the certainty that is required in order to establish damages. And we've cited the court numerous cases where courts have refused to determine damages based on case reserves on existing claims or on incurred but not reported claims that have already been incurred but have not actually come to the insurance company's attention. But the evidence that we have in the record that shows that we had no adequate remedy law and shows that the damages were too speculative to be determined at this time over a 30-year period of potential claims that could occur on this block was, number one, that when Cologne, through its subsidiary, JHA, priced this block of business and back in 1998, they said there was going to be profits on this business, and there turned out to be losses. So right from the beginning, we found this to be a very difficult block of business to price. Secondly, Mr. Zeiker, the actuary, testified before the district court in the bench trial and said that there were losses the first year of over $7 million. The second year, there was a small profit. The third year, there were multi-million dollar losses. The fourth year, there were small losses. The fifth year, there were substantial losses. What the testimony before the court was that we had showed that there were substantial variances in what the performance of the block was going to do over a five-year period. Mr. Zeiker also testified that this block was particularly difficult to determine what the losses would be in the future, particularly on claims that you don't even know what they're going to be, because there was reinsurance on some of these blocks of business claims already in existence. So that some of them may be 100% reinsured by Swiss Re, some may be have zero reinsurance, others may have partial reinsurance. And that's a determinative factor in trying to decide.
In the briefs, unless I completely missed it, you didn't respond to Cologne's argument that courts would not generally order specific performance in a situation that requires a protracted monitoring of performance. It seems it's going to take 30 years for these insurance contracts to play out to completion. Are there any cases where a court ordered specific performance that would grind on for 30 years?
I don't know the answer whether it would grind on for 30 years, Your Honor. What I do know is that this is a typical reinsurance agreement where you would reinsure the risk on this block for a period of time. These parties, Your Honor, had worked together in 1997 and entered into the almost identical type of agreement, and that has worked from 1997 going forward. Mr. Perkins, the Cologne actuary who was involved in this, said he didn't see any difficulties with the parties agreeing on how the reinsurance would work in this.
Is that why you took your chances here and didn't demand something in writing from Cologne?
The reason we didn't demand something in writing from Cologne back in 1998, Your Honor, was that there is a history of between the parties. We had worked side by side. And in this deal that I was referring to in 1997, where actually we, Trustmark, reinsured Cologne 50%, and Trustmark did the claims administration, the parties agreed orally to do the reinsurance arrangement in April. Trustmark took over claims administration in July. Money was transferred from Cologne to Trustmark in July, and the parties signed the documents in December of 1997, approximately 6 months after everything was put into place. In addition, what we had before the court was testimony of the acting director of insurance in Illinois, James Schacht, who was a 30-year regulator, who testified that reinsurance is something that is often done on a handshake. Trustmark had done other deals with other parties on a handshake. You have to look at the industry that we're involved in. Reinsurance has a history, perhaps resulting in more litigation than it should these days, but has a history of doing deals where they reach an agreement orally and then subsequently document the arrangement. I'd also point out that Mr. Perkins, Cologne's chief actuary here on this deal, agreed that it was not necessary for the parties to execute the documents back in 1999. They agreed to wait until everything was buttoned down.
And this is just a question out of curiosity.
Sure.
Has the practice changed now? Because there's certainly a fair number of cases we get on reinsurance that deal with this very issue, not having the agreement in writing. And it appears to be one of the few industries where such a practice exists. Is that the practice now?
It is certainly changing. I don't believe it has changed, Your Honor, but it is changing. But in this case, there was a relationship here between these parties. They had worked side by side. They thought they had a deal. They had done deals just like this before. Everything was going smoothly with the relationship between the parties. Unfortunately, economics changed here. And in particular, in Cologne's situation, they had a huge change in their financial condition as a result of an unrelated piece of business that required them to establish reserves of $275 million. Under those circumstances and the resulting change in senior management, they walked away from a deal that Mr. Perkins told Rowan Bell, one of the Trustmark's actuary, was a done deal, that they put in writing to other third parties that they were successful partners in acquiring this block of business. That there are writings that essentially, if you put together collectively, do show what the terms are going to be. And under these circumstances, where we're just talking about Trustmark doing the claims administration and doing the policy administration, and the essential term here is that Cologne would share the risk 50%, that it does not seem difficult at all for a court to order specific performance, particularly where the parties are sophisticated in doing this business and are able to have worked together in the past under this very similar circumstances.
Now, is this correct? The red brief at page 36 regarding Mr. Zucker testifying that, quote, a gross premium valuation would generally involve your best estimates and might very well be different than the statutory assumptions. Trustmark chose not to engage in redirect examination of Zucker on this point and put forth no other evidence to contradict Zucker's testimony. Is that true?
It is true that there was no redirect on that point, Your Honor, and the reason there was no redirect on that point was that the reason that Cologne asked that question and got that answer was because they were arguing at that point that the damages on the known claims, the damages that we were seeking up to that point on partial damages, was too speculative and that there were alternative methods that should be looked at. They actually made this the other argument, and it was and never below made the argument that there was an adequate remedy at law. They were trying to tell the court that it was too speculative and too uncertain to even give us damages based on known claims. And that's why we didn't redirect on that point, because that was not what the purpose of the question was.
So a best estimate of future losses is not enough?
A best estimate is a term of art in the actuarial industry, which shows it's sort of a midpoint. It's based on an estimate that is out there based on the information that you know, but it doesn't tell you how good that estimate is. We cited to you in the brief the Social Security Administration, where they use the term the best estimate, their actuaries, to say when is the Social Security fund going to go insolvent. Their best estimate is 2042. But they also say it could be 2032, and it could be still solvent in 2078. So the best estimate may be something that's there, you know, based on the information they have, but you would certainly never award damages based on that knowledge because it is too speculative. And remember, Your Honor, what the Second Circuit said in the Jeep Eagle case is that if you're not certain that money damages can make you whole, you should err on the side of using specific performance. And that's what the treatises say as well. Here, equity requires for specific performance will make the party whole. They will make sure that they do exactly what they agreed to do when the promise was made back in 1998. If you go forward and estimate based on whatever knowledge there may be in the record, and it's assuming claims going out 30 years, then you will inherently be taking a stab in the dark. And we have cited the court six different cases which say that even claims that have already exist are too speculative to determine damages. So under those circumstances, we think that specific performance is the appropriate remedy here. It is the fair remedy here.
But one way to do it is to use a gross premium valuation, isn't it?
It is one possible way to do that, to estimate what that number might be, but it doesn't tell you what the range is, Your Honor. It doesn't tell you if it's, you know, 90% certain, if it's 10% certain, if it is throwing a dart against the wall. And so under those circumstances, it doesn't give you the standard that's necessary to award damages.
And the five-year numbers would not be helpful in that process?
Well, the five-year...
Which fluctuated...
If they showed perhaps a steady trend, that's possible. But under this circumstance, we've got fluctuations up and down, and we have a history here of missing actuarial estimates all the way through. So this is clearly a very difficult block of business to determine what the value would be. I point the court to the Second Circuit's decision in the Wolf case, too, where the Second Circuit said we will not take your best estimate because the best estimate isn't good enough for determining damages. It is much like, in that case, they said it was a bid estimate. And a bid estimate was not sufficiently detailed for them to award damages under those circumstances. Here, if you're trying to price what the business would be, you may take a risk, but under those circumstances, it doesn't mean that it is sufficiently accurate and certain in order to provide the necessary damages. Your Honor, I'd also like...
I have a global question here. If you would address the theory behind this particular exception to the statute of frauds, this partial performance exception, seems to me to be rather circular, particularly as it's applied to a promissory estoppel claim.
Well, the theory behind it is that we received a promise from Mr. Perkins that he would share the risk with us 50-50.
I'm not talking about the facts of this case.
Yes.
I'm talking about common law theory globally. I mean, statute of frauds bars a contract claim or a promissory estoppel claim.
Right.
If the promise was to extend beyond a year.
Right.
Right. And there's this partial performance exception.
It requires
may or may not apply to both claims. Apparently it applies to a contract claim, may not apply to a promissory estoppel claim. As applied to the promissory estoppel claim, I think it's completely circular, but that's what I want you to address.
Because, well, the additional requirement is that you have to show the detrimental reliance that you took this action in, you know, essentially because you relied upon the promise that was
right,
made to you.
That just restates the elements of a promissory estoppel claim. So, you know, the exception to the statute of frauds is the same thing as the elements of the promissory estoppel claim, which is totally circular.
I believe it's the Fisher versus First Capital case actually talks about the fact that the detrimental reliance is not necessarily the same as the promissory estoppel claim.
What's the difference? I know that's what the case says, but it doesn't explain it.
All right. As I understand it, the reliance that we're the difference is that we have a promise that required us to go forward with this, that we relied upon to go forward with it. And then we continued that action on a going forward basis. I think that the detrimental reliance is something that is a continuation that we continue to do under these circumstances. Apparently, I'm not quite understanding.
I'm still not following, and this just, you know, may be my own lack of understanding of Illinois law, but I'm still trying to understand what the basis of this particular exception to the statute of frauds is in the context of a promissory estoppel claim, because it seems to me that the exception to the statute of frauds merely restates the elements of the claim, which makes no sense.
You have to have a higher standard is all I can think from what I've seen in the case law.
The reliance forms the basis of the exception has to be something different than reliance.
It has to be for that purpose that the reliance occurred, or substantially that's why you have taken the actions that you have taken.
But here it's the same thing. The reliance that forms the basis of the claim is the reliance that forms the basis of the exception to the statute of frauds.
That's true, but we also, detrimental reliance is that we entered into a long-term arrangement. So not only did we sign up and agree to the letter of intent, but we also took it the next step and we took over the claims administration, we took the policy administration, and we continued to take the actions that were necessary in order to perform under these circumstances. So I think that there's a continuation argument.
Why would this particular exception be applicable to an equity claim and not a claim at law, a claim for damages? What's the theory behind that?
I think it's because that the court doesn't want to countenance a situation where a party suffered detriment as a result of the promise that was made, an unambiguous promise that the other party knew was going to be relied upon. The equitable result would be specific performance seems to give it the most complete relief under these circumstances.
Specific performance of the whole bargain?
Under this circumstance, I believe it's the only way to make the parties whole under these circumstances.
So you couldn't get damages for the whole bargain, but you can get sufficient specific performance of the whole bargain.
Under this particular scenario, that's right, because equity wants to make you whole. It seems to me that you can, that if in this circumstance, the only way you can be made whole is if you receive the specific performance.
It seems to me that this exception to the statute of frauds provides an end run in all situations around the statute of frauds, if it's interpreted the way that you're arguing.
But it would require limited to equitable relief under these circumstances, and equity, it seems to me, requires that there be some remedy for these parties under these circumstances.
Well, usually equity will give you a remedy for just a very limited situation. For example, one of the cases had to do with employment, and you'd get a remedy for the period of time that you actually relied upon, but not for the whole employment contract if it extended beyond 2 years, or beyond a year, excuse me. But in this situation, you're asking for a remedy, yeah, which constitutes enforcement of this entire reinsurance agreement for 30 years.
We're asking for enforcement of that. Your Honor, I am using in my rebuttal time.
I'm
going to
give you a couple more minutes.
Thank you. We're asking for full and complete relief that would provide us with the results here. I'd also point out that we have substantial exceptions that we believe that the district court erred under these circumstances on summary judgment and not allowing us to proceed. That statute of fraud should not have applied here given the writings that were available, given the testimony of Mr. Perkins. So we do certainly believe that statute of fraud shouldn't apply under any circumstances here.
Should not have?
Should not have.
Even though we're talking about a contract expected to last 30 years involving tens of millions of dollars, weren't you taking a chance by not demanding something in writing from Cologne?
Well, we do have things in writing from Cologne.
But the writings that you have don't memorialize an existing joint agreement or promise, but at best what they suggest is an expectation to enter into an agreement sometime in the future.
But what they said is that they actually have done the deal, that they've said we have a done deal, that we will have a retro on these terms. Under these circumstances, Your Honor, we had a letter of intent that the parties negotiated and that was approved, as Mr. Perkins said in his deposition. He approved those terms. He was ready to go forward with that. The letter of intent said what the bargain was going to be over the next 30 years with respect to this block of business. We also had a final agreement that Mr. Perkins wrote on that they would accept a retro on those terms. The terms that are going to be applied here are essentially a 50-50 split. And that is all we're talking about here is they would split the risk on this block. We would do the claims administration. The parties agreed on the costs that each side would have, that is set forth in Mr. DeMarco's analysis in writing that was sent to both sides. So when you take together all these circumstances, when you take together the writings that do exist and the fact that in the reinsurance industry that there are not usually as much writings to detail the terms, we certainly meet the custom and standard of this industry for us to have presented to a trier of fact whether or not the writings were sufficient.
Thank you, Mr. Bird.
Thank you.
Mr. Hassan.
Morning. May it please the Court, I plan to address three issues. The first is the finding that the statute of frauds barred the promissory estoppel claim. Second, an alternative basis for affirmance that Trustmark did not establish the elements of promissory estoppel by establishing a clear promise. And the third, that the court was correct in finding, the trial court was correct in finding that there was no joint venture in this on the facts presented to the court. Trustmark concedes that in order to escape the statute of frauds, they must establish that there was partial performance and that it is in need of an equitable remedy. The trial court found, as a matter of fact, that Trustmark had an adequate remedy at law. That finding was not clearly erroneous. In fact, it was the only finding that could be made on the trial record. Mr. Zeiker was the only witness who testified as to damages. He was a company actuary, and he computed damages as follows. He looked at the cash that the company was holding for Cologne, and the statutory reserves required by Illinois law that Cologne would need to establish, and he found that the reserves exceeded the cash, and that difference would be the amount of loss that Trustmark would incur. And he explained by would incur that means that's an estimate based on statutory accounting principles and statutory reserves. He explained there was an alternative method you could use using best estimates, the same procedure, perhaps slightly different assumptions, and you might come up with a slightly different number.
This may sound very simplistic to you, but why did Cologne set up a $2 million reserve unless it thought it had bound itself to cover those losses? Because To me, at any rate, that's the most conclusive evidence that you both thought you had a binding deal.
At the time, it was part of a $300 million increase in reserves that the company was posting because of some other unanticipated losses. And in an abundance of precaution, and at the time where they were still expecting that they might do this deal, they put up the reserves. But companies put up reserves all the time on matters where they are not legally liable, in an abundance of caution. And that's what generated the reserves in this case. Mr. Zeiker didn't testify, and no one else testified that the methodology he was using to compute the estimate of losses was speculative or unreasonable. And clearly, Mr. Zeiker, who is a company actuary and who sets the statutory reserves, would not be in a position to say that this was guesswork and that it was unreasonable. All that Illinois law requires is that there be a reasonable basis for damages, not absolute certainty. There was no contest in the record that these at all that these damages were speculative, and Judge Manning's findings were clearly had a basis and were not clearly erroneous. The cases cited concerning the alleged unreliability of actuarial estimates, to the extent that they apply to damages instances, are cases where someone made at the trial court an estimate and someone attacked the estimate, because you can always attack these estimates because they're based on various assumptions, and that's what happens in a trial. But no one here, it's certainly not Trustmark, alleged that their own estimates of damage were unreasonable. So those cases have little effect here. Incidentally, looking at the record in those cases, those are casualty insurance and not the kind of life disability insurance we're dealing here, which is a totally different.
You just dropped something that might be important to you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Oh, it's wonderful to have an obsessive compulsive at the
I appreciate anxiousness. It. I appreciate it.
The judges, procedurally, the judge's ruling on this came up on this issue came about in response to a motion for reconsideration of the order that was entered after the bench trial. Is that right?
After the bench trial, we moved for judgment as a matter of law based on the evidence. She made rulings denying that motion and made certain comments about the establishment of a promise. Then she said, submit proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law, which the parties submitted on both, on all issues, and her order was based on those proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law. So it was an order she entered after we had submitted the case to her and on all of the issues.
And you advanced this argument that's now being advanced and that she ultimately, that was ultimately dispositive of the case in the district court in that interim time period?
Well, we...
Or did she come to this on her own?
They stated that they had no adequate remedy at law, and they cited to the record, the record didn't support it, the testimony of Mr. Zeiger didn't support it. Our position with Mr. Zeiker was, at the trial, there was a suggestion that these were actually, on a cash flow basis, losses sustained by Trustmark. Our position was that these are mere estimates as to the future based on statutory principles, and you could use other actuarial processes to get perhaps even a better estimate. But we did not attack the underlying methodology of these rulings.
My question was, did you advance this argument that the specific, that the partial performance exception to the statute of frauds is only available where equitable remedies are sought, not where remedies at law are available?
Excuse me, Your Honor. Yes, I did. I'm sorry. We did. We We did that at the conclusion of the summary judgment motion. We did it at various stages during the trial, and we also did it as part of our proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law. Excuse me, I misheard you.
And what's the legal effect of that that memorandum decision that the trial judge entered after the bench trial that is quite detailed and contains the court's evaluation of the evidence on the promissory estoppel claim, but is not in the form of findings and conclusions?
No. It was on a motion, on our motion for a judgment at the conclusion of their case. It was not based on proposed findings of fact or conclusions of law that had been submitted.
Okay.
But she made fact findings on those arguments.
Well, she did in connection with the submissions made on the motion for a judgment, but she, after she made those that ruling and those findings, then she asked for proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law on all of the issues in the case, including the issues in which she had made certain rulings on, including the issues of the promise. So that's what the direction was from her after she issued that order.
See, I've had some difficulty trying to understand why you urge us to find that the district court alternatively should have granted summary judgment on the promissory estoppel claim, because she made fact findings that are completely inconsistent with that argument. And I don't see any attempt to show that her fact findings were an error. I mean, I don't know why you don't just stick with her decision that Trustmark met the requirements for the partial performance exception, but the doctrine applies only to claims for equitable relief.
Your Honor, we believe that as a matter of law, the evidence that that the trial court cites to is not sufficient evidence of a promise. And the evidence in the motion where she discusses this is evidence of the party's expectations. It is evidence of whether the principals for Cologne expected to ultimately do a transaction, and the evidence, and the same thing for Trustmark. There is no evidence that Trustmark either sought or received a promise. There's no note of any conversation where any such promise was made. There's no draft agreement. There's no confirming letter. All there was evidence that the parties were negotiating with a deal, on a deal. In the case of Impro versus Impro Manufacturing in this circuit, some years back, that case recognized that under Illinois law, the parties are free to engage in preliminary negotiations and preliminary understandings without fear of being trapped in a situation where they can't ultimately disagree to do the transaction.
So, if we want to just simplify, cut to the chase, get to the bottom line, Judge Manning found that because Trustmark had an adequate remedy at law, namely money damages, she ruled against Trustmark. And isn't that the beginning and end of it here?
Well, I think that is the end of it, Your Honor. I think that there's one other issue, though, that involves the issue of promise that goes to the question of equitable relief and whether it could possibly occur here, and that is what was promised and what was enforced and what would guide the court over 30 years. We have a situation where at the time this alleged promise occurred, Trustmark was handling claims in its Lake Forest office. During the period of time while the parties were still negotiating, it was clear that wasn't working. They had to have an entirely new office. There's evidence in the record that they weren't handling claims properly. How does that bear into the enforcement? There's evidence that that Trustmark and Hartford actually negotiated the purchase price they were going to be paying, renegotiated the purchase price that Trustmark was obligated to pay Hartford. There was no agreement by Cologne as to that ultimate price. How does that play into this? What would happen when losses are presented? Is it going to be an estimate that the court's going to look at? Is it going to be an actual loss payment? How much is Trustmark supposed to be to be compensated for the claims that are made? What if there's a dispute about whether the claim is proper? There are written agreements between the parties, if there had been one, that would govern these things, but there wasn't sufficient evidence that could form the basis of any type of equitable relief or specific performance in this circumstance. Quite apart of whether you think there was some evidence of a promise, enforcing it for over 30 years would be impossible for the court to do.
Well, speaking of some of those writings, especially Perkins' language, couldn't we construe that language not to indicate that it was due to a lack of a joint venture agreement, that is the conditional nature, but rather due to the lack of finality of a purchase agreement with Hartford? And so if we looked at the two writings together, we might be able to find a joint venture agreement that satisfies the statute of frauds.
Well, Your Honor, the only writing with respect to Mr. Perkins is a letter that he sent to another insurance company as part of a sales pitch, which Trustmark concedes. There was a reference to a partner there. It concedes that there isn't, that had no legal significance. They were attempting to show that these parties were working together. And it doesn't specify what the terms of the joint venture are or what the terms of any kind of obligation are, which is a requirement for the statute of frauds exception. Nor does Mr. Perkins' testimony fairly constitute an admission or a description of what the obligation would be under the specific terms of this deal. And there's no attempt by Trustmark to try to put all this together and explain how, if you combine all of these agreements, that you would come up with an agreement. You combine all of these writings, you would come up with an agreement. One further issue I would like to raise, and that's on the joint venture. It hasn't been shown by Trustmark what exactly they're buying by there being a joint venture finding here, if they were to have one. Would it excuse them from showing that there was a contractual obligation to reinsure this particular risk? In their complaint and on the summary judgment papers, their joint venture theory was that Trustmark and Cologne were looking at these disability blocks of insurance, and assuming that you could find that there was a joint venture, which the court correctly found there wasn't, it still doesn't lead you to a conclusion as to how that would obligate Cologne to do this particular transaction, unless you could show there was some writings or some contract that under which they were obligated to go forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hassan.
I have some additional minutes, Your Honor.
Yes, two additional.
Thank you. Then let me be brief. First of all, I want to make clear that what the damage analysis that Mr. Zeiker did was based, and he testified to this fact, based on actual damages that had occurred and were actually being considered by Trustmark at that point. He was not talking about calculating future damages under these circumstances. And these are contracts of indemnity, and as contracts of indemnity go, the liability doesn't accrue until sometime in the future.
Well, where in the cross-examination will we find that?
With respect to the fact that financial analysis of the block was limited to the actual damages, page 934 of his testimony says the financial analysis of block was limited to claims Trustmark knew about, reserves on those known claims, reinsurance on those known claims, and premiums collected and claims paid out. It does not in any way talk about what the claims are going to be over the next 30 years. He doesn't have that information. He then went to statutory tables based on the fact that we have identified these particular claims, and that's what the losses are likely to be under those tables. He never tried to say there's gross premium valuation, could determine what the value of the block was going forward or the losses on that block going forward throughout its life. I would note that there were six actuaries that testified in this case. I know that's probably it makes it an exciting trial, but it wasn't in that perspective, but none of them ever talked about gross premium valuation. There were two, other than the question pair that Mr. Zeiker was asked about, there were two from Cologne. None of them ever talked about gross premium valuation being a basis to determine reasonable and certain damages under these circumstances. With respect to...
So what do we do with, okay, now if you were to give a best estimate of the actual losses on the Hartford block at some point in the future, one way to do that would be to use a gross premium valuation. Is that correct? Answer, that is correct.
Your Honor, he does say that. I'm not going to argue it, but he says one way that could be done. He's saying it. Best estimate is an actuarial term that talks about range.
How many ways does a judge need?
You need to have a certain way to do it. There are many different ways to do it. You can pick it out of the sky. You can throw dart. You can do anything, but there has to be one particular way that is actually going to lead to some certain result here. And here, there is no testimony that there's going to be a certain result. Indeed, what Mr. Zeiker said is that the gross premium valuation method is going to lead to a different number than the statutory tables that he used.
And are you arguing that there is always a way to show that certainty?
I'm saying that there isn't.
No wonder actuaries are paid, trillions.
Well, I'm not sure they're paid trillions. At least my friends who are actuaries don't admit to that. But what they try to do is establish a range of what it's likely to occur, some sort of standard deviation within which is the loss. But there isn't testimony and there isn't case law that supports that this is a reasonable determination of what the value is going to be over the life of this block of business. I'd also point out to Your Honor that we wanted reinsurance. We wanted someone to share the risk with us, 50-50, and we wanted somebody to stand beside us who was economically strong so that we wouldn't have to deal with catastrophic results that may or may not occur somewhere down the road. Under these circumstances, that's why we entered into a reinsurance oral agreement here for 50-50 or writings that supported that. But what we didn't do was to try and was to be willing to take the risk all by ourselves. And the policyholders are better off if Cologne is side by side with us. We're better off if Cologne is side by side with us. This is how we want the bargain we thought we would deal with. We had reinsurance credit that we can no longer take if we don't have reinsurance. We have to increase our reserves. The risk to Trustmark is substantially increased, and it is not dealt with by trying to pick a number sometime in the future as to what the loss is going to be.
Did either side's proposed findings and conclusions attempt to fix future damages?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Indeed, just the opposite. I think counsel is in error at the post trial findings of fact conclusions of law. They made an argument that this was too speculative for the actual damages based on existing claims.
And whose burden was it?
It is on that issue, I'm not sure it's burden. It is our burden to show there's an inadequate remedy at law. We did show that, Your Honor, by showing the change, the difficulty in evaluating this block, by showing under these circumstances that that there's 30 years of losses here, and we showed that there's a wide range of performance under this block. If I could also point out, with respect to the reserves, Mr. Schacht, the director of insurance, says that you do not establish reserves unless you believe you have a liability on that business. Mr. DeMarco, their Cologne's own actuary, or JHA, the subsidiary, said he has established reserves, and he's never established reserves on a block of business that he did not believe it had liability on.
But if we're talking about tens and tens and tens of millions, what is $2 million?
It shows intent. It shows what they thought they had, Your Honor. It shows that they thought they were a party to this agreement. To establish $2 million on a block of business that you don't think you just have involved preliminary negotiations just does not make sense. It shows that they understood that they agreed that to accept liability on the Hartford block. And everything else before the court showed that as well. And I will say that Judge Manning, in her findings of fact, you know, on the judgment issue, ruled in our favor on all those points. And she relied very heavily on the reserve as well. And I appreciate your time. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.